We're talking about parables of Jesus. It's not the only way Jesus taught, but it's one of the more powerful ways Jesus taught. This is true in general. Jesus just happens to be particularly brilliant at this. I mean, I think we learn well from stories in general. We're kind of storytelling creatures. I think we're made in the image of God, and God is the crafter, creator of the truest stories in the world. So I think they resonate with us, and they particularly resonate with us with Jesus. I want to look at a parable I think has, on the surface, it's one that you probably all heard. I think before I even became a Christian, I knew about this parable. But the idea in this parable is a powerful idea, and it has ancient and modern implications. And so I want to make a particular application to see how might we apply this story. So what we want to talk about tonight is, won't you be my neighbor? We want to talk about the idea of being a neighbor. The word neighbor comes from Old English. I mean, it goes through various forms to come to us, but in Old English, the word neighbor means near dweller, someone who dwells nearby. So the earliest idea for us of a neighbor, this word in English captures the idea of it. It is the people in our vicinity, if you will. For us today, it may be more than just our geographic vicinity, because it may be that people come across our paths because we're very mobile. So I would think people that are near in the events of our lives, you know. So you get the sense of someone who lives near to us. So the idea of being a neighbor is more complicated than it sounds. And one of the ideas is, who is my neighbor? But the second idea is, what does it mean to be a neighbor? So, for example, that is not a trivial question. What does it mean to be a neighbor? I mean, it could be as simple as tidy up after your dog. And I'll live with that. I'll take that. You know, that's improvement. This middle one is my favorite, is stay in your own area. Okay, that's a good neighbor. Have you ever heard the old saying, good fences make good neighbors? Yeah, and that's just the idea that, you know, drawing a boundary line that, you know, we just kind of respect each other's space a little bit is a good thing. So the question, though, of what does it mean to be a neighbor and in what sense do you be a neighbor is actually an ancient question and a very, very modern question. So I want to talk to you about the parable of the Good Samaritan. This is just one parable, really short. What this essentially is one little interaction in Jesus' life. And yet, it echoes down through the millennia. This is probably the best-known parable of all the parables. And I say that simply because even people that don't know the Bible or read the Bible know what the phrase Good Samaritan means. We have Good Samaritan laws. I mean, that phrase can be in your vocabulary, and you might not even know it comes from the Bible. It's just very pervasive idea. So this particular parable comes from a specific incident. And let's start by opening it, and I want to look at this incident. It says, behold, a lawyer. And so, lest you think that this is an anti-lawyer parable, what that word actually means is an expert in the law of Moses. So you'll see the phrase a lot of times, that's not the phrase here, but a lot of times scribes, you'll say the scribes and the Pharisees. Who were the scribes? Scribes were people that could write. They were highly trained then, as they are today. If you write a Torah scroll today, you have a lot of training to go through. So they would write copies of the Torah, the law of Moses, first five books of the Bible. I mean, all the Old Testament, but basically the Torah. And so in the process of making their living by copying the Torah, well, they kind of learned the law of Moses pretty well. And so this doesn't say he's a scribe, but it does say that he's an expert in the law of Moses. So it's not lawyer like we think of a lawyer. It's more religious authority. So he stood up to put Jesus to the test. So the question he's going to ask him is a question that is debatable by the rabbis. There's several of these questions that Jesus gets asked. He gets asked to try and pin him down and say, are you of this rabbinic school or are you of that rabbinic school? Is this your theology or is that your theology? It's kind of inside baseball for Jewish theology. But they want to pin him down because then you can know, well, now I know whether I'm for you or against you and I know how to attack you. So he's testing him. They ask Jesus, can a man divorce his wife for any reason? Was John's baptism from God or from men? Should we pay taxes to Caesar or not? You know, so they're always asking Jesus questions, trying to test him. So he's asking this question, and he says, teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life? Translated for us, what do I need to do to be saved? That's what he's asking. What do I need to do to inherit eternal life? What do I need to do to be saved? And Jesus answered him and says, what is written in the law? And when he says the law, he means the Torah, first five books of your Old Testament, the law of Moses. What is written in the law? How do you read? How do you read it? So two things here. One is, it's interesting that Jesus answers that question by saying, what do the scriptures say? Which is the first place you should always go to get an answer to our questions. If God has an opinion, I would like to know what it is, right? And so he says first, what does the scripture say? I mean, Jesus is not a fool. He knows you're an expert in the law. You've read it. What does the scripture say? How do you read it? That is an interesting little phrase. Because you see, they thought Jesus, he didn't go to any of the universities. He didn't go to the rabbinic schools. So they just thought he's a yokel from Galilee. Oh, maybe he's a good preacher, maybe he's a good speaker, but he doesn't really know the law very well. That little phrase is a very technical phrase that you'll see in other rabbinic writings. What he's asking, I mean, it's going to sound like he's a rabbi. I mean, it's like, oh, you know how to speak our lingo. You know how to talk the way we talk. What he's asking him is, what's your hermeneutic on that? How do you interpret what the scripture says? Because the rabbis spent a lot of time in different camps interpreting the scriptures in slightly different ways. Still do it today. So it's a very technical question, and it puts Jesus, elevates him like, I'm not a yokel. I understand this stuff really well. So he says, what's written in the law? How do you read it? And the expert in the law answered, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength and with all your mind. So you're probably familiar that that is Deuteronomy 6:5. And your neighbor as yourself. You should love your neighbor as yourself. And that is Leviticus 19:18. So he's summarizing the law of Moses. There were 613 laws in the law of Moses. And then the oral law of the Pharisees, there were hundreds upon hundreds more. Okay, so he says, how do you read the law of Moses? You want to know what it takes to be saved? What do you need to do? He says, you should love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. He is summarizing the law. Sometimes, because Jesus himself is going to say the greatest commandments are these, and he'll list these too. He's not saying that's all you need to do to be saved. He's actually, the answer is, you need to do the law of Moses. That was given by God. You need to do it. What he's saying is, and what the lawyer really accurately captures is, if you had to give a short summary of the 613 laws, these two summarize them. Does that make sense? We have this little phrase we like to use as Christians, all you really need to do is love God and love people. Yes, and really no. I mean, in the sense that, yes, you most certainly need to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And you should love your neighbor as yourself. And that's a good summary of the law of Moses. And if you want to keep the law of Moses, good luck. What I would say, if you said, now what do I need to do to say, believe on the Lord Jesus Christ. And that's what you need to do. And then you will love the Lord your God with all, it all comes with it, right? So it's a summary. It's not a shortcut. Like, I just want the two. I can only do two. Give me two, right? So this is a summary. And he gets it exactly right. the rabbis had kind of understood this idea that, you know, that all the laws, if you really wanted to, you could link them all to this idea of loving God wholeheartedly, obeying him, because that includes obeying him, and then loving your neighbor. And so Jesus said, you have answered correctly. Go do this and you will live. That should be the end of this conversation. And it's sort of like a, well, that's nice. You understand the scriptures, go do that. But he came and asked him this to test him. But the expert in the law, desiring to justify himself, said to Jesus, but who is my neighbor? So his point is, he wants to drill down, and he's like, yeah, I know you're supposed to love God and love your neighbor, but we just can't be out there loving everybody. Okay, we got to make this a little more specific. And oh boy, did the rabbis have a lot of arguments about that. And in fact, I would suggest to you that people today have a very different answer to this question. Who is my neighbor? That question is a very, very modern question. You know, who is my neighbor? To whom? What he's really asking is, if I'm supposed to love my neighbor as myself, that's an obligation, if you want to think about it that way. I owe my neighbor to love them as myself. Then I need to narrow this down, and I need to know, to whom do I actually have that obligation? Because surely it's not all human beings. I mean, that would have been a given in that culture and at that time. And so I want to walk through a couple of ideas on how they would have answered that question. Who is my neighbor? Let's start with the Jews, then we'll go to the secular society, and then we'll come to modern society. But how you answer that question is not trivial, and it actually informs a great deal of how you're going to behave. So in our world, let me just skip forward now. The reason why I think this is such a big question is we live in such a partisan, tribal kind of culture, is we really have a hard time answering this question, who's my neighbor? We're really no different than this expert in the law. He really very much wanted to narrow this down and say, I'm all in on loving my neighbors myself, but I gotta know what small group of people is that, right? We still have that issue. And the sense with political partisanship, we get the tribalism. Of course, Darwin, and I can't move on this without making just a comment on the secular world. The secular world is not very consistent on this idea, because if you're a Darwinist, if you're an evolutionist, you fundamentally have a problem with this. I mean, I know you want to love your neighbor, but you really have to ask yourself, what does one animal in the jungle owe to another animal in the jungle? Nothing. It's the will to survive, right? It's me first and maybe you later if I've got something left over. I mean, a Darwinian worldview, there are no neighbors. There are no neighbors. Now, I know you don't know any secular people that want to live that way, but that's fundamentally, we are the inheritors of that Darwinian idea. Consequently, we also want to shrink this down. And we kind of get into the tribalism that we see. Well, the Jews answered that question in moral terms. So here's just an example. This is not from the scriptures. This is from the intertestamental period. If you're Catholic, you've read this. It's in your Bible. It's in the Apocrypha. The reason I'm quoting this for you is not that it's inspired. It's an example of how did they think about this in those days. And so Sirach says this, give to the devout, but do not help the sinner. Do good to the humble, but do not give to the ungodly. Hold back their bread and do not give it to them. What's happening here? You get a very religious, moral answer to the question, who's my neighbor? Moral, religious people are my neighbor. Wrongdoers, proud people, sinners, they're not my neighbor. So consequently, I want to just pause for a second. This is going to explain a lot of what you see in the Gospels. The Pharisees are constantly looking down on Jesus because he eats with sinners. And tax collectors, they got a whole different name because they're even worse, right? But he eats with sinners. That's interesting because you and I are thinking, and what's the big deal with that? Well, it's a big deal if you think those are not your neighbors. They're not righteous. They're not worthy. They're not moral. They're not religious. So they answered the question, who's my neighbor, is the other Pharisees, the devout people, the people that aren't sinners, right? So that's how they tended to answer those questions. This expert in the law, that's pretty much how he answered that question. And that's the answer he wanted from Jesus. Jesus, he wanted to say to Jesus, so I have to love my neighbor as myself, but really, who's my neighbor? And Jesus went, well, of course not the sinners. You know, that's the answer he wanted, and that's the answer he expected, but it's not going to be the answer he gets. But I want you to know where he's coming from. Yes, question.
So would the tax collectors and the other sinners, the categories of those, would they have been allowed to have been their physical neighbors?
Would they have lived near each other? Not by choice. That's exactly right. Not by choice. You get these gradations, right? I mean, and we still do the same thing. This is an ancient story. You could just make this a modern parable. So if you're a Pharisee, you want to live around Pharisees. Orthodox Jews today in Israel, to the extent that they can, live in Orthodox Jewish communities. In fact, there are whole towns that are built for Orthodox Jews to live together, not wanting necessarily to live to unobservant Jews or Jews that aren't Orthodox. Same idea here. You wouldn't live with the less observant Jews. If you're less observant Jew, you wouldn't live near the Gentiles. Do you remember Peter in the book of Acts when he gets this dream and he's supposed to go see this Cornelius, the centurion, who's a Gentile, goes into his house and he says, you know that it's unlawful for me to even associate with you. I mean, it's part of the story. It's a great story. But my point is, everybody's got their circle, right? Very tribal, very insular. So could you? Of course, you could live near them, but they would not by choice. They would segregate themselves morally. They would also segregate themselves physically. Good question. The Essenes, this is from Dead Sea Scrolls. So the Dead Sea Scrolls are probably written by an even more conservative group of Jews than this lawyer and this expert in the law. They certainly broke the neighbor thing into morals, but they didn't even recognize the temple as being legitimate. They saw the world as divided into the sons of light, them, and the sons of darkness, you. And so their division was even more than moral and religious. You could even be, this lawyer would not have been in for them, would not have been their neighbor. Their neighbor are the people that believe the right thing, that are looking for the end times. It was more of an eschatological idea. You're on the right side when the final battle comes. So that line got drawn in a different place. You can see why this question, who is my neighbor, is not a trivial question, then or now. Secular world, the fundamental idea in the secular world, and I would argue the secular world then and the secular world today. Not many people are going to say this, but most of the people that are secular live this. Love your friends, hate your enemies. Do harm to your enemies. This is all over literature, all over the ancient literature. The idea that you should do good to your friends, be faithful, be true to your friends. You should do harm to your enemies when you can. And that's virtuous. That makes sense? That's not like we're just not nice people. They're like, no, this is how nice people act. If you're a good person, you hate your enemies and you do harm to them. So how do they answer the question? Who's my neighbor? My neighbor or my friends? And everybody else is the other. That's still the case today. That's a very Greco-Roman secular way of looking at the world, is friend and enemy. It's not moral. It's not like the Jews. It's not eschatological, who's going to be on the right side. It's slightly different. It's like, who's close to me, either familially or emotionally, may not even be geographically close to me, but my friends are my neighbors, and everybody else is not my neighbor. Yeah, it's a different answer. Amy Chua, this is just an example of kind of modern-day tribalism. We answer this question in the same kind of way. This one happens to be political, and for a reason. I want to make this political because this is how we tend to divide neighbors. The left sees right-wing tribalism, and it is tribalism. Bigotry, you know, left-wing sees the right-wing as bigoted and racist, as tearing our country apart. The right sees left-wing tribalism, and it is, identity politics, political correctness, woke, what we typically refer to as wokeness, as tearing the country apart, and they are both right. You know, the point there is that we are very tribal. The point I want to make is we answer this question even slightly differently. Not moral, not eschatological. A lot of secular people would answer this question, love your friends, hate your enemies. But we've morphed who our friends and enemies are into political categories more and more. Have you noticed that? It's fascinating to me to see polls that people would say, I would not marry a Republican, or I would not marry a Democrat. I'm not taking a side. It's really interesting that think about this 100 years ago. No one would have answered this question in this way. They might have said, love your friends, hate your enemies, right? Or my neighbors or the people in my denomination. Or, you know, they would have answered it some other way. But today, increasingly, people answered this question, are you in my political ideological camp? That's how we're defining neighbor today. And so you see that tribalism. Tribalism is part of fallen humanity. Tribalism always leads to violence, so don't, well, I shouldn't have to tell you that. We just had some recently. I mean, we've had more and more violence. That is a natural outgrowth of tribalism. We have political violence now because our answer to who is my neighbor, we answer it in political terms. And so our tribes become political, not moral, political, right? And consequently, our violence is political violence. In Roman and Greek days, you would kill your enemies. You would assassinate your enemies. Because they weren't your friends. Today, your friends are whoever. You know the old saying, politics makes for strange bedfellows? What that's saying is it alters the old lines of who's my neighbor and who's not, and recasts it into political ideological terms. But the point I'm trying to make is how you answer that question is interesting, and different people answer that question in different ways. We're interested in how does Jesus answer that question? But before we get to that, I just wanted us to see that this is not a trivial question. So, he asks him the question, who's my neighbor? And this is the occasion for Jesus to tell this story. So this is a story you're very familiar with. I mean, you've got six verses. This is unbelievable. This is just a little short story. Jesus answered him. This is how Jesus answered him. There was a man. I want you to notice there are four categories of people in this. You have the victim. There was a man going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he fell among robbers, the victimizer, who stripped him and beat him and departed, leaving him half dead. Now, by chance, a priest was going down, and this is an indifferent character, road, and when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. Also, a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, another indifferent person, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, this is the fourth category, Samaritan, who is the concerned person. You have a victim, a victimizer, indifference, and concern. So you get this dichotomy here. Jesus is setting up a way of thinking about who is my neighbor. And he's looking at these different categories of people. Now, keep in mind that Jesus turns things upside down. So he's going to answer this by specifically talking about a priest and a Levite. A Levite was one of the 12 tribes of Israel, the descendants of Levi. They didn't have a land allocation. They lived all amongst the other tribes. And the Levites were dedicated to service to God. So they might have a farm or something, and they may make their living, but they would take turns to come and serve at the temple. So they, you know, did all the work at the temple, where they were the doorkeepers, the choir, etc. They did all this work at the temple. They were the only ones that could do that. Priests are descendants of Aaron, the brother of Moses, and the priests are the ones that would do the sacrifices, and they did the priestly duties. These two classes of people were both devoted to God. They were typically thought of as being holiest of the Jews in some sense. In other words, they were like, today you might say it this way, you're not just a regular Christian, that person is a pastor. Well, you and I know that's a false distinction in some sense. We're all pastors in the New Testament. We're all priests, right? But it's that kind of thinking, like, okay, you're even holier than others. And that's why Jesus chooses them. He could have chosen, he could have said an expert in the law was walking by. But he chooses this to set up a sharp distinction to make the point. Now, to be fair to these two, why are they passing by? They are passing by because they have a conflict. And therein lies the essence of answering that question. Their conflict is this. This guy might be dead. So even if I want to help him, if I go help him and I touch him, now I'm ritually unclean. And I've got to go through a great process. And this is all according to the law of Moses. They're not breaking the law of Moses. They are not understanding, Jesus said, the deeper things. The idea that love your neighbor as yourself is a greater commandment. So they don't want to become ritually unclean, so they go by on the other side, because if he's dead, that's bad for them to have touched him, right? So they value the community of being clean and being able to go to the temple and being able to go to synagogue and so forth. They value that more than this guy's situation. Now, the Samaritan is the person who should be the absolutely least concerned person. So Jesus sets up this good dichotomy. This is a good story, is a story that's kind of black and white, makes the point. I got the holiest people and I got the least holy person, right? So I'm going to make this easy for you to understand, Jesus says, what I'm about to say to you. And so he says, the Samaritan, however, when he saw him, he had compassion, and he went to him and bound up his wounds, poured oil on him and wine, set him down on his animal, took him to an inn and took care of him. And the next day he left some money for the innkeeper, saying, take care of him, and if it costs more, I will repay you when I come back. So he just goes above and beyond to show compassion to this individual. So take a little side trip here for a minute, just talk about the Samaritans. A lot of this you probably know. But it's interesting because the Samaritans were hated by the Jews. You all know that. But they were hated by the Jews on many, many levels. It was on many levels. At the first level, it was ethnic. So this is in 930 BC. From 930 to 722, you get this division. You get 10 tribes of Israel. These are Israelites living in this northern kingdom called Israel. And capital city is Samaria. And then you get two tribes living here in Judah, and they split. So you kind of have a split amongst the Jews, but they're still all Jews. Well, along in seven, so they do fight each other, but religiously they see each other as fellow Jews. So 722 BC, the Assyrian Empire conquers this northern kingdom of Israel, and these 10 tribes get carted away into exile. They get dispersed throughout all of the Assyrian Empire. They forcibly resettle them and split them up. It was their policy. It was their national policy. Conquer people, ship most of them out, bring in people from other places. Then no, who's going to rebel for land that isn't even theirs? That's brutal and ruthless, but it's pretty smart. And so they take these 10 tribes and they scatter them. And this is where the 10 lost tribes of Israel got lost. I mean, they literally get absorbed into the pages of history. So the Assyrians take over and they resettle a bunch of non-Jews in Israel. And so you have some Jews left, a lot of non-Jews, and they mingle together, and they are not Jews anymore, according to Judah. Judah does not get conquered. So time goes on, and let's get down to the time of Jesus. Now we move from 722 to the time of Jesus. In the Roman Empire, this whole area called Judea, this whole area is a Roman province. And Samaria is one of the northern states, and Judea is the southern state. So they're all mixed together. You remember the saying that a lot of the Jews, if you were coming from Galilee, you wouldn't go through Samaria. You'd cross over, and you'd go this way, and you'd go around Samaria because there was so much ethnic animosity between them. But what's even worse than the Samaritans just not being ethnically Jewish anymore, they claim to be Jewish, and that was even worse. They had their own copy of the Torah, first five copies. It's called the Samaritan Pentateuch. It's the Samaritan copy of the first five books. But instead of worshiping at Jerusalem, their Bible was changed to say you should worship here at Mount Gerizim instead. Do you remember when Jesus, who did go through Samaria, meets the Samaritan woman at the well, has a conversation, and she says, "Why are you a Jew even talking to me? Like, I hate your guts, you hate my guts, you shouldn't even be here," right? So, I mean, it's animosity, a lot of animosity there. And Jesus says, he just says, I'm not worried about that. He said, "I'm going to give you water, living water." So he has this interesting interaction with her. Well, she goes, "Well, clearly you're not like every other Jew, but I hate Jews because you Jews say that we're supposed to worship in Jerusalem." And Jesus says, "Yes, and we're right." I mean, there's no coddling, you know, there's no seeker sensitivity here. It's sort of like, yeah, you're wrong. But the day is coming when you're all going to follow the Messiah, right? So the reason she says that is because she's right by Mount Gerizim and says, this is where we worship. So they have an ethnic animosity to one another. They have a religious animosity to one another, but it gets worse than that. Down through the ages, in like about, if you remember the Maccabees, in about 167 BC, the Greeks ruled this whole area. Romans haven't gotten here yet. And so when the Greeks come in, they try to stamp out Judaism. So the Samaritans tell the Greeks, stamp it out by killing you. You can't circumcise, you can't have a copy of the Bible. They're killing Jews. I mean, it's horrible, horrific. It's just ethnic cleansing is what we would call it today. So the Samaritans went to the Greek rulers and said, "We're not really Jews. And in fact, if you'd like some help, we'll help you stamp out the Jews in Judea." And they do. And so they fight against them. So they've got this ethnic clash, they've got a religious clash, and they just got bad blood because you guys helped and you fought against us, right? By the way, today in the world, there are still Samaritans. There are about 1,000 Samaritans left today that live in two places, one in the West Bank near Mount Gerizim and the other near Tel Aviv. They're two enclaves, small enclaves, about 1,000 Samaritans still alive today. But so they hated the Samaritans, and they hated them for hundreds of years, and they hated them for a lot of reasons. I mean, I want you to understand the depth of what he's saying here. In fact, the depth of what he's saying, you'll see in just a minute, is so bad that the lawyer won't even say the word. So Jesus tells this story, and he's answering the question. He's setting up this situation where the most holy people don't help this guy, and the least holy guy actually does help this guy. So what are you doing here, Jesus? I mean, if you're the lawyer, you're like, where's this going? I just asked you, you know, who's my neighbor? And you go into this story about these people helping him and some other people not helping him. And so he wants to know an answer. How do I divide the world between the good guys and the bad guys? Who's my neighbor and who do I not owe that commandment to? And Jesus says, he answers it this way. He turns this question completely upside down. Which of these three do you think proved to be a neighbor to the man who fell among the robbers? And the lawyer says, he can't say the Samaritan. He just says, the one who showed him mercy. And Jesus said, that's the answer to your question. Go do that. Well, that's an extremely unsatisfying answer, right? I asked you, who's my neighbor? And you tell me this story and ask me which one guy acted like a neighbor, and I said, well, it was the one that showed him mercy, and you just told me, go do that. You didn't help me at all. You didn't cut down the number of people I have to love at all, right? You left me hanging here. What Jesus does, and I want to take another mild detour, what Jesus does is he ties this in to another teaching, and this is the golden rule. This is a teaching that undergirds a lot of things, but this is in Luke chapter 6. What he's doing here is he's basically kind of applying the golden rule. As you wish that others would do to you, do so to them. He says, if you love those who love you, what benefit is that to you? Even the sinners love the people that love them. So this, love your friends and hate your enemies, Jesus said, that doesn't make you any better than the sinners. They do that too. So that can't be the answer to your question. And if you do good to those that do good to you, what benefit is that to you? In other words, if you're only going to like the moral people, then what good is that? It's sort of a quid pro quo, right? And if you lend to those from whom you expect to receive, what credit is that to you? Even the sinners lend to sinners and get back the same amount. He says, but I want to turn this around and say, why don't you think about loving your enemies and do good and lend expecting nothing in return? And you will be rewarded, and you will be sons of the Most High, for He is kind to both the ungrateful and the evil. Bottom line, be merciful, even as your Father in heaven has been merciful. So now all of a sudden you start to see that this story Jesus tells, he's not answering the question, he's sidestepping it, and he's coming at it from a completely different angle, but this is the angle he's coming at it from. The idea is he's changing the question, who's my neighbor, which is a category, right? That question is, what category of people? Is it the moral people? Is it the people that I'm friends with? Is it people that share my political ideology? Is it people that share my ethnicity? He asked that question as a question looking for a categorical answer. Does that make sense? And we still do too. We still define who is our neighbor. If you just pay attention to the news, you will see that it comes down into, tends to come into categories, right? Good guys, bad guys, ethnic people here, not ethnic people. Democrats, Republicans, liberals, conservatives. We answer this in categories. It's very convenient, very easy, and that's what the lawyer wanted. Jesus comes at this, and he actually looks like he's trying to answer this in more of a terms of, you have received mercy, so I expect you to be merciful. And you're like, well, what in the world is kind of answer is that, right? How does that carve things up for me? It actually doesn't answer the question. It completely turns the question around. Jesus says, his first answer is simply this, I can't answer your question the way it is asked because you have assumed that the answer is a category, and the answer is not a category. There is no category of people that you should love, that and you're welcome to not love the other people in that are outside that category. He simply rejects the question the way it's asked. And I would argue that let me just give you an example in our political discourse. We tend to reject the premises of almost all the political questions of our time. As Christians, I want you to think about that for a minute. He says, well, are you a Democrat or a Republican? Actually, I don't agree with the premises behind that. Does that, you understand what I'm saying? Jesus is not willing to play the game of, well, here's my world. I have categories. Now, which category? And Jesus says, I don't have categories, so no, I'm not going to answer your question. You see what I'm saying is a lot of questions we get asked and think we need to answer are framed with certain assumptions we do not share. That's what Jesus is doing here. I can't answer your question the way it's asked because I don't agree with the whole category system that you have. So Jesus turns this around and he's going to answer it in a different way. And so he comes back and he says, which of these three then do you think proved to be a neighbor to the man who fell among the robbers? So instead of answering, who is my neighbor? Jesus answers a different question. What do I need to do to be a neighbor? Be merciful. Do you see that what he's doing? He's not even trying to be difficult. He just says, that's a meaningless question. The question you should be asking is, what do I need to do to be a neighbor? And that's why he asks, which one do you think proved to be a neighbor to the man who fell among the robbers? It's not a category question anymore, is it? Even a Samaritan can be a neighbor. And he doesn't fit in anybody's category. To whom do I owe mercy? That's another way of framing this question. And I think it's the way we tend to frame questions a lot, is to whom do I owe mercy? And Jesus actually says, wrong question. Jesus' question to you is, are you merciful? So what does the Samaritan have going for him in this? The Samaritan only does one thing right. He's got his religion wrong. He's got his ethnicity wrong. He's got bad history. He's unclean, according to the Jews. The guy's got nothing going for him. He only has one thing going for him. He actually has a little compassion and shows mercy on the guy. That's the only thing the Samaritan has going for him. That's by design. Because Jesus says, if you want an answer to your question, that's the one thing. And you're actually asking the wrong question. Who's my neighbor is not the question. The question is, if you want to have eternal life, what does it take for you to be a neighbor? You want to know, who do I need to be merciful to? Jesus' question is, are you a merciful person? Does that make sense? It's not even so much that he turns it around. He just answers a different question. He goes, that question has no meaning. So I want to apply it just a little bit and ask this question. It comes down to, in that story, indifferent people and concerned people. Merciful people, people that put something ahead of mercy, okay? And so that's really the distinction that he's making. It's not a category, because you could be a Democrat, a Republican, you could be a friend, you could be an enemy, you could be a Samaritan, you could be a Pharisee. Anybody could fit into Jesus' definition of a good neighbor, couldn't they? As long as they're compassionate and merciful to one in need. So Jesus is answering that question. Where we tend to want to try to slice it, we don't actually want to ask the question, who is my neighbor? We want to ask the question, okay, I know I'm supposed to be concerned about people because I'm a Christian, or even if I'm a secular person, I believe in the unity of humanity and love for all human beings, right? Unless you're Republican or Democrat. But, you know, in general, love for all human beings. You know, it's all have a Coke, sing kumbaya. You see this on commercials all the time, the sentimentalism of our culture. You know, we're all just one big family, except when we're not, you know. So, I mean, it's not consistent, but that's what we want to believe. Our question is what does concern for my neighbor look like? What does it mean to be concerned for a neighbor? And the question of immigration is one that I think is really easy to apply this to. I mean, it's not an easy question, but it is an easy one to kind of demonstrate this. Immigration was not controversial until relatively recently. So on a political, legal sense, immigration around the world used to be, until relatively recent times, immigration was not particularly controversial. The idea of who could come into your nation, this is a relatively recent question. We've only had nation states for, you know, a few hundred years. But basically, the question of who can come into your nation, well, it's whoever I say. This is true for any nation. And who do I want in? Well, if I have a labor shortage, I want people that can come in and work. If I have a skill shortage, I want people that can come in and have skills. And no matter who comes in, I want them to assimilate into my culture. That was the answer to everybody's immigration. You may have different immigration standards. You may have different immigration quotas in Saudi Arabia or Soviet Russia or the United States or Canada. Everybody thought about it in that way, is what can you do for the well-being of our country, and are you willing to assimilate into our culture? Learn the language, adopt the general morals and so forth of the country. That was not even mildly controversial. And today, this is very interesting to me. Today, immigration is probably one of the most controversial things, and not just in America, right? It's in all of the West. It's not controversial in some parts of the world, but it's very controversial in the secular West. Interesting thing about that is, and it comes back to this idea of neighborliness. Now, I want to take one thing off the table. There's no doubt that some of the immigration debate is fueled by political self-interest. Okay, that's just true, right? In other words, some people that don't want immigrants because it serves their political interests, some people that do want, say, unlimited immigration because it serves their political interests. I want to set that aside. That's just cynical. I mean, it is what it is, and it's cynical, and that's that. But if you get into the Christian world, so I'm going to narrow this down to the Christian world, you do still see this division, right? In the Christian world, you'll see some people that will support the idea of very limited immigration for traditional reasons, and other people would say, but wait a minute, that's not what Jesus taught. Everybody can be your neighbor, right? And consequently, you know, things when you hear things like Jesus was an immigrant, right? Jesus, if we'd had immigration laws, Jesus would have never made it back from Egypt into into Palestine. And I mean, you kind of hear, if you've heard those things, that's a Christian making an argument, applying a moral category of neighbors to a modern issue of immigration. So the real question there is the idea of what does it look like to be concerned with people? So this question of who is my neighbor and what does it mean to be neighborly really comes down to what does it look like then to be concerned about it? This question becomes in the Christian sphere a way of actually accepting what Jesus said. We need to be merciful, but then trying to answer the question, what does mercy look like? Some Christians are going to say mercy looks like letting anybody that come into this, I'm just restricting myself to immigration for a minute, letting anybody come into this country that needs to come into this country, okay? That's the only way to actually be compassionate, be a neighbor. Other Christians won't disagree on the idea of being neighborly and having mercy, and I want to be charitable about this. I think if you leave the cynical reasons out and you just deal with people of good intent who want to argue a Christian cause, both sides of this issue tend to agree that we do want to be neighborly. We want to be merciful people. The question comes, what does it look like to be merciful people? What are the means by which you would be merciful people? That's a legitimate point of discussion, I think. And I just kind of want to cast that in that light. But if you wonder why Christians are on two sides of this issue, and I mean Christians who are trying to be merciful, who accept Jesus' definition of being neighborly, it is really more a debate over what does concern actually look like. It becomes more pragmatic as opposed to moral. Question.
Are we being asked to be merciful to the robber?
Now, that's a slightly different thing. Good question. Merciful to the robber. I want to shift from immigration to just a general victimhood thing. You know, we kind of have this, it's actually mildly dark anti-hero thing we have going in our culture, and that is the idea of sentimentalism towards the victimizer. And you tend to see this, I want to call this sentimentalism, because it's not just I want to be merciful, it goes beyond that into, well, I'm so concerned about how the robber might have had a bad upbringing that made him be a robber, and this might be partly true. I mean, it's a fallen world and a hard life, and I have so much sentimentality for that person that I lose sight of the fact that there's also a victim here. And I start to lose sight of the fact of, is there a victim? Who is the victim here? That's fundamentally sociological insanity. I mean, I don't mean that to be, I'm not trying to name call. I'm saying, if you just look at it, you go, that's insane. I mean, just clinically, I mean, that's insane. That makes no cognitive sense whatsoever. It's not exactly the same thing as the immigration thing. That's actually taking sentimentality and over-applying it and losing any sense of reason or proportion when you apply it. That makes sense? That one's not even close. Immigration, people of good faith could disagree on what does concern actually look like, and I think that's a rational discussion. There's a right answer to that and a wrong answer to that. This question about, I can't even tell the victim from the victimizer, is sociological insanity. I mean, that's just taking sentimentality so far you can no longer see reality. Is that the reality of this is, and you'll get a little of that in the immigration thing too, because anytime you give somebody something, you just took it from someone else. And I'm not saying that we don't share. As Christians, we voluntarily share, right? But this idea of we need to forcibly take things from some people to give them to other people, you've now moved outside the biblical ideas a little bit, and you're more into more secular thinking. But yes, that's a great example. I would argue it's maybe different than immigration, but that's what I would call the epidemic of sentimentality. I have a soft heart for everybody, and I'm all for having compassion for everybody, but when you get to the point where you lose sight of reality, and that losing sight of reality is nothing new. I mean, I don't What is a woman? Don't know. Can't answer. Not a biologist. Sorry. Yeah, I mean, this is not new. You understand this. We've kind of moved into a little bit of an insane period of time.
Okay, so how does this apply to people on the side of the road, the ones holding signs, asking for help, etc.?
Great question. How does this apply to people on the side of the road holding signs? Let your conscience be your guide. Compassion and mercy. You and I both know that some of that's a racket. I mean, actually, you and I both know that most of that is a racket. And I don't mean that there may not be people who need help, right? And so compassion is never misplaced. It's never a bad thing to be compassionate. It's a bad thing to be overly sentimental and lose sight of reality. So the question really becomes, how true compassion is this: what builds you up? What helps you? Sometimes it's a swift kick in the butt. Sometimes it's a lot of compassion and encouragement. Sometimes it's giving you money. Sometimes it's giving you food. Sometimes it's getting you help. Do you understand what I'm saying? It's not a simple little sentimental answer, right? It's like, what helps a drug user? Giving them drugs? No, that's a sentimental answer. That doesn't really help you. I love you enough to do something if I can to help you. And honestly, you can't always help. You're not the one that can help in every situation. But back to the question, not trying to dodge the question. You'll never fail by erring on the side of compassion, but do what actually builds people up. You know, a lot of people will just, give out cards to the shelter. And if people need help, you get that help. But I would let your conscience be your guide on that. But be wise. Wise as serpents, innocent as doves. But if you're going to err on the side of compassion and mercy. Okay. So a lot of application of this idea. And there's there's some cynicism happening. I mean, if you have political reasons for wanting, whatever your issue may be, if you can tap into Jesus' teaching and somehow contort it to be what you want, and say, look, if you're a Christian, you have to be for immigration. If you're a Christian, you have to be for fill in the blank with whatever issue you want. Of course you'd love to co-opt Jesus' teaching, but we need to be a little wiser than that and actually understand what is Jesus saying. He's calling us to be merciful people. He's not calling us to be foolish people. In other words, we're really not going to go and say, oh, that poor victim, but you poor robber. You know, I think I'll give you a scholarship. You know, I think I'll get you. Yeah, that, in other words, you have to look at the whole picture. In other words, you can't, what builds up in that situation? The person who's hurt is the one that really needs the help. The robber honestly probably needs to be incarcerated for a moment so that you can quit doing this to other people, because, man, you're just heaping coals on your head. You're making this worse and worse. We need to put a stop for the good of all of us, right? So there's a little sensibility included in this. But I wanted you to get the idea of the actual biblical teaching is about, are we going to be merciful people? But mercy isn't sentimentalism. And I'm glad you asked the question about sentimentalism would say, I'm just as concerned about the robber as the guy who's beaten up. Well, they may both be a concern, and they may both be a concern to society, but the guy who's been beaten up needs help right now. Let's do that, right? I think the immigration debate is a great example of that. I would cast that not in political terms, although clearly there are cynical political reasons, but amongst the Christian community, this needs to be a real discussion about what does it look like to be concerned? Does that mean open up the borders and let everybody come in and everybody's quality of life goes down and things don't go well here? Or are there other ways? There's not a robust discussion, because there are a lot of other ways to show compassion and concern in this situation, and we're not having that discussion at all, which tells me that it's not a rational discussion. You know, we're starting to draw our little categories and fit in our little tribal holes. I would argue that as Christians, we're not necessarily saying, well, do you take a Democratic or Republican view on that? Wrong question. I'd rather take a Jesus view on this. In other words, compassion is not optional, and what really builds up, that's what we're going to talk about. That discussion isn't even happening, but we as Christians ought to be the lead in that kind of discussion.
What is the significance of the word as in loving your neighbor as yourself, as opposed to loving them more or less than yourself?
Right, and that's a great question. You probably heard sermons on this. The idea of loving them as you love yourself, the New Testament talks about this in some other areas too, but let me tell you what it doesn't mean. It means I get what I want, and if there's anything left over, I'll do it for you. It's me first and you second. It's like, no, you're my brother. You wouldn't treat your family, well, maybe we might treat our families that way, but you don't treat your family that way, right? We are brothers and sisters, and so it's like, I will share, right? And it's not loving them more. Jesus doesn't call you to be a martyr. And it's like, well, my family's going to starve so I can be a good Christian. That's an out of balance. The as yourself is a very balanced way of looking at that. Does that make sense? Which, by the way, ties back to our first set of parables about how do you deal with your wealth? Love your neighbor as yourself. And that's not a prescription. Jesus doesn't say that means give it all away. He doesn't say give 50% of it away. He just says, let that be your guide. Now go. Love your neighbor as yourself and be a merciful person. And he never really answers the question, exactly how merciful? Is it 12.5% or is it 12.7%? Wrong question. You see how Jesus doesn't really answer questions in the categories that we have. And so having the mind of Christ, all that really means is trying to understand, where's Jesus coming from? I know where the world's coming from. I know sometimes where I want to come from. Sometimes I want to say, Jesus, who's my neighbor? Remember Peter said, how many times do I have to forgive my brother? I was thinking 7 would be really good. And Jesus said, I was thinking 77. You know, in other words, where's Jesus coming from? That's why we do Bible studies. We don't do Bible studies to win trivia contests and know more facts. We try to learn to go, how does Jesus look at these things? I like this parable, not just because it's about this issue, but because it helps me realize Jesus has a unique way of looking at everything, and that's how we want to look at things, is the same way Jesus does. Well, Jesus' parables, I told you in the first lesson, a ton of Jesus' parables are about possessions, because he knows it's a fallen world. We tend to fall in love with them, and he says, I'm going to help you with this. I'm going to tell you how I think about this, right? The other category of parables that Jesus has a ton of parables about are parables about judgment and justice. And so I'd like to end the series talking about just selecting a few of his parables so we can learn to think the way Jesus thinks about the idea of justice. And I'll give you a hint. It's not the same as fairness. So go out there in the world this week and don't be fair, because that's not Christian. All right, I'll see you next time.